Years ago, I wanted to make better syllabuses for my course. Better syllabuses. And I discovered in the other institution I taught that anything you wanted to do with a business office, there was always a big wrangle. They were pleasant enough, but they didn't want to spend a nickel. And if you wanted to make a syllabus of 2 pages, they'd look you right in the eye and say, well, couldn't you get by with half a page? And so I decided to get out of that, and I bought my own mimeograph machine so I could make syllabuses as big as I wanted. And so I soon was making fat syllabus. Syllabus, incidentally, is not a proper Latin word. You can pluralize it any way you want and be right. Those who say syllabi are probably just as wrong as anybody else. It probably is a fourth declension Latin noun in which syllabus is both singular and plural. It doesn't exist in ancient Latin, so nobody knows for sure. So you can say syllabuses, syllabi, syllabus, syllabus. And people think you're dumb, but if you're worried about what they thought, you probably wouldn't be at an institution like this. So anyhow, that's what I did. I made bigger and fatter. After I got tired of having a mimeograph machine, so I bought a multi-lit. Now, buying multi-lit soon put you into a new league. And everything is cheap until you start getting it, and then all sorts of wonderful things happen in the expense factor that you can hardly believe. Possessing the multi-lit as a kind of a hobby is one way of guaranteeing that you will not have a large estate to leave your children. But a man up the road here was giving away some ink. His company had more ink, so he told me he would give me 150 pounds of ink. That is a lot of ink for a multi-lit. However, only 20 pounds of it were black. 20 pounds were green, 15 pounds were chartreuse, 20 pounds were apricot. And I took it. I took every pound of it. Since then, Mr. Rivera's father-in-law has given me another 40 pounds and some other off-color type ink. But for anything that you really do for the school, you have to use black ink. You just have to do it, that's all. So anything I can kind of do when I don't have to set the press up with black ink, I use these other colors of ink and claim that saving myself eventually the day when I have to start going out and buying black ink. So I used ink today, a few original spots in the paper, a few smudges. That certifies these being ours. That's how we do it. And I'm not known as a neat printer. In fact, I am a very sloppy printer. But my claim in the printing business is that I get it done. Of course, if the press would break down or the building would blow up, anything could happen. But I get it done. And if I tell you it'll be done on Tuesday, it will be done on Tuesday, albeit there might be a thumbprint right smack dab in the middle of it, but it will be done. Our discussion for this morning is not my printing press, but religious liberties and state infringement, which is a highly emotive topic. And I'm not sure that I've handled it well in these notes or that I'll handle it well in this hour. But if you could only talk to the subjects that you know you're going to handle well, it would greatly limit the field of your participation. So I dash into these things, too. It's something I think about a lot, something we read about a lot, and something that I'm enormously interested in. But the field is a huge one, and there are a number of emotive factors in it that really crop in on you in a special sense. And I'm not sure that I can or will treat them all in the time that we have. But I will stick with these notes pretty carefully. I'll pause from time to time, and if you have a question or a statement, we can pick that up, too. We'll try not to move with such blinding rapidity that nobody knows where we are. But that's where we are, religious liberty and state infringement. You remember that the Institute theme relates to the general concept of the Bible and world affairs. And I mention here the rather important thing of noting this pendulum principle, which you all understand, and that is that pendulums tend to swing equally in the arc. The scientific terminology is never with me, but it tends to go as far on one side as it was on the other side. That's the way it goes. And what I've tried to urge people to do is to make the stroke short when they set the pendulum in motion. It doesn't have so far to react. And what I'm saying there is that if the state gets into a situation where the church is very highly favored, it may very well be in 100 years exactly the opposite will be true. It's very much like France at the time of the French Revolution. Dr. McCrae alluded to it the other day in his devotional talk Wednesday morning. But in 1600, there was hardly a more religious country in the world than France, probably. And in 1700, probably not a country anywhere that had a higher degree of apparent fascination with the Roman Church. Ireland might have been the exception to that. But in 1700, France was certainly one of the one or two countries in the world with the highest percentage of participating Catholics of any country in the world. But by 1793, the church had been outlawed, thousands of priests had been martyred, The Pope was soon to be dragged off to France and forced to sign a concordat with Napoleon to give up everything he had, and a whole bunch of other interesting things. So the great situation in France went from a place where the church could do no wrong and governed everything to where it was thrown out, and the nation was pronounced an atheistic nation, and the Roman church was outlawed. The Napoleonic concordat would save that situation to some degree, but that's the way the pendulum is. And so if today you find that there's an erosion of certain liberties, it may be the movement of the pendulum against certain aspects of privilege in time past. It may be that. If that's the case, see, I'm not wise enough to know, but if that's the case, there is relatively little you can do except to figure out how to work with the pendulum as it moves. That's not a very optimistic thing to say, but if that's the case, that's the way it goes. We've been seeing it in labor relations in recent years. I think they are beginning to stabilize. I don't know. I think they are. And again, I'm not an expert, but my folks came from England to mine coal in western Pennsylvania. That's not why they came here, but that's what they wound up doing. They mined coal in Wales, and so they wound up mining coal in western Pennsylvania. And I tell you without batting an eyelash, you can sit in all the idealistic castles you want, but they had a miserable life for about 50 years. A miserable life. In a situation, oh, they had their good days, too. They fought with one another, and there's nothing that the English like better than fighting with each other. But on the whole, they had a tough life. It was epitomized, I suppose, with my great-grandmother, whose husband was widowed. Her husband wasn't widowed. She was widowed. When her husband died, when her oldest child was 14, he left her with 12 children. The oldest child was 14. The oldest boy was 12, and the next oldest boy was 10. They lived in a house in a town in Gastonville, Pennsylvania, which was owned by the mine company. They lived there, and they were paid week by week by scrip. Now, I wasn't on the scene at the time. Obviously, it's my great-grandmother. But my great-grandmother said that the day after they buried Joe Rogers, the mine officials notified her that if the two boys did not go to work in the pit the next day, they were 12 and 10, she would have one day to vacate her house. You get the feeling of that sort of thing. Now, you can say what you want. At least they could have given her 2 weeks. But you can say what you want. They lived a very difficult life. And suddenly, Johnny Lewis swept up on the scene. Like him or not, he swept up on the scene. He organized the miners. He was willing to fight. He was willing to do all sorts of blood-curdling things. In a period of time, they had a much better life. And then the pendulum went the other way, where they threatened to run the whole country. And that's kind of the way it goes. It swooshes back and forth. You cannot really stop it in the middle, I don't think, unless there's a great catastrophe. It's hard to stop it in the middle. But it's rather nice to try and make sure that the swings of it are controllable in the movement of things. Now, that really relates to what I'm saying here. When we talk about religious liberty and state infringements, it may be that some of the infringements are in areas where we have been irresponsible. You hate to think that, because naturally, we don't like to think we've ever been that. But it may be that some of the infringements may come in areas where we have lived with total mobility and freedom and have been irresponsible and now feel a pinch rather heavily because a degree of responsibility is called that we'd like not to have called. I'm not going to answer that immediately, but keep it in your mind somewhere because that's the way the pendulum moves. At the same time, I caution you against the wolves and the sheep. You know, there are some people that everything that happens cry, wolf, wolf. Everything is a major catastrophe. The whole world is going to collapse. They hear that Marilyn Murray O'Hare is going to Washington to talk to Senator somebody. She shows up in the news of things that have been settled 10 years ago about every 5 months in our church. Somebody comes in with some wicked thing she's doing. She does plenty of wicked things. There's no problem about that, I don't think. But everything that comes up is a major issue. And between those that cry wolf all the time and those that just are being eaten and don't know it, it's hard to find an exact medium ground between that. Do you know what I'm saying there? The people who everything they do, if they heard that Senator Hines had decided to play golf on Sunday morning, he might do it every week for all I know, but if they heard that he decided to play golf on Sunday morning, they would immediately assume that he was going to introduce a bill in the Senate to make playing golf an admissible form of worship in addition to the passing of church. They would immediately assume it, see? And the criers of wolf, after a while, you don't pay any attention to them. Then when a real problem comes, you don't know what to do. I've gotten so many pieces of legislation of somebody who said, look what the Congress is going to pass, and they send you a piece of legislation. What I have done with those things is to immediately call my congressman's office and ask for the whole bill. They will send it to you quick, especially if it's election year, they will send it to you quick. And when you get the whole bill, you discover it's as big as a telephone book or an insurance policy. The whole bill is huge. But I have more than once found some of the wolf criers taking a sentence out of this paragraph and a sentence out of that paragraph, which, technically speaking, really isn't honest unless you show the context and all that sort of thing. So between those who are, I'm the kind that gets eaten, see, but between the type that cry wolf a lot and the type that are, you know, just can't, they're insensitive to everything, there's a hard point to find a difference between them. But in the matter of religious liberty and state infringement, you have to find it somewhere. Not every act that goes against what we want to do is an infringement on our religious liberty. Not every act is that. Not everything that we want to do is always right or within the bounds of liberty. All you have to do is survey the Christian public at large, and you'll discover that there's always somebody who in liberty thinks he ought to run away with somebody else's wife. There's always somebody like that who justifies some type of action on the ground that his conscience will let him govern. So when you come down to the whole concept of religious liberty and state infringement, it's a big emotional conflict. And it's very hard to discuss it, see, without getting overly emotive, and hard to discuss all the facets of it. The particular areas of alarm, I mentioned five. Particular areas of alarm in which we see state infringements moving on what you'll see I discuss religious liberty later, but state infringements, I mentioned five. I can't go into them in detail, but the hiring practices, the concept that persons must be hired for advertised positions without regard to religious or social or moral standards. Now, that hits you hard if you're in a church situation and you're advertising for a secretary. You just advertise in Christianity Today like a secretary for your church. And the person who shows up secretarily for your church is competent in every particular way except he or she. I don't know what, you know, we're not worried about the sex of the secretary at the moment, but they're competent in every particular way except that they're Unitarians and don't believe your church stands for anything. Now, at that point, if you make the faith situation of your church a condition for employment today, you're subject to prosecution, if anybody pushes it. If anybody pushes it. 9 times out of 10 right now, nobody pushes it. But at that point, you're subject to prosecution. I heard William Ball from Harrisburg give a lecture on that subject in which he mentioned 3 cases, one involving a Catholic archdiocese in Cincinnati, in which the hiring of a person contrary to the religious belief of the school was sustained in the courts because the school had advertised for a person to teach this particular subject, and the fact that the person didn't match them religious-wise could not be made a test of it. Now, there have been a few cases where those things have gone the other way, too. But that's the hiring practices is one of those things. There are lots of wrinkles in it. There are lots of loopholes. But that's one of the areas. Likewise, this concept of defining organizations, the government taking into itself to define what is a religious organization, what is a non-charitable organization. I'm not saying the government can't do some of that sometime, but it becomes one of those areas where they infringe on us. There probably is no better case of that, I suppose, than the Bob Jones case, although there are other cases very similar to that, in which the government defines them as not being a charitable organization because of their lack of willingness to comply with a particular government edict or with an HEW edict, as the case may be. For right or wrong, that poses one of those problems. So you get into a situation where the government might very well, they can't do it today, but the infringement is they might very well come and say, well, yours is really not a church. Really not a church. Why is it not a church? Well, particularly if you're independent, see, it's really not a church because, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we have had some striking situations around here with the tax rebel Robert Graham. Robert isn't in the room today, obviously. At least I haven't seen him this morning. I haven't seen him for 2 or 3 months. And again, forgive me, I'm not a pronouncer of right or wrong, but Mr. Graham decided to constitute his family as a particular church. I don't know how that finally went out. The government was having a second round with him on the school that he and another man were teaching on how to not pay income tax and various other things like that. These fellows move too fast for me. But you can easily see that if every family in a community constituted itself a church, And then if all of the laws with regard to churches not paying taxes, you could have a situation in which in every town, every house constituted itself a church, and there was no tax base for the... I know it sounds absurd, but you could get there. So somewhere along the line, the government may well have to define those things, but as soon as they begin defining them, then becomes grounds for infringement on some aspect of things. It may become that. Likewise, I mentioned the use of public property. Well, the public property, we mean the high school gym, or that sort of thing. President Reagan attempted to secure a passage, so far it has failed, that school facilities and public building facilities could be used for religious activities not sponsored by the school but by exterior persons, just as other groups could. But so far that has failed. As of right now, that's a dead issue. It may come to life at any moment in the legislative alley, but right now it's a dead issue. So it means that if my children go to North Penn High School and want to have a prayer meeting in the early morning in a classroom, they may not do so legally. They may do so if the school doesn't fuss about it. Happer Horsham years ago, the principal of the school, although not a religious man, said he valued every organization like that they had. He was not a religious man. He said kids that are in a room praying together, he said, are not out using cans and spraying graffiti on the walls. So there were four or five prayer groups that met at Hatboro Horsham. They just met, that's all. They didn't have the official sanction. They just met. But there was no attempt to keep them from not meeting. However, technically speaking, as it stands today, the major edicts have made that sort of thing illegal if any issue is raised upon it, the use of those properties for that sort of thing. In New York State, they still have the release time Bible classes, but you release them and they go to your church. At one time in Pennsylvania, we released them and they stayed in the school. You know, anybody that wanted to go to religion could be released and you'd go down to the worst possible room in the building, I suppose, be like this auditorium, and there you could have a religion class. But in Pennsylvania, that has been discontinued for some time now, the use of the actual facility under those laws. The fourth item I mentioned is this concept of the insistence on secularized standards. By secularized standards, I mean standards in which no overt or known religion is practiced. Frankie Schaeffer puts it well in pointing out that secularism is a religion of its own. There's no doubt about that, I think. But the secularized standards is the idea that if you run a foster home for children, if you run a foster home for children and receive aid from the state, now if you just run it for yourself, brother, and take every waif that comes by, that's another story, but if you run a foster home for children and receive children who are appointed, Pennsylvania is one of the best states in the world right now to work on these things. Might change any moment, but in Pennsylvania there's greater liberty on these things than almost any place I know of. But in many states, and if it receives aid, see, and then consequently they insist it be secularized and that no religious inculcation be given there. If you want to go to Sunday school, you can certainly go to Sunday school, but daily devotions with your children and that sort of thing would constitute a breach of the secularist principle, and you'd be liable for prosecution. There are a number of other incidents like that, and probably the most famous ones in our day and age were the battles that Lester Roloff had down in Texas. I don't suppose he was totally innocent either, because I'm not totally innocent, and you can see what a good guy I am. But the battles that he had in Texas, because he insisted that as part of a huge work for down-and-out children, a religious instruction be incorporated. I don't know where that is today. I haven't heard since Lester died. They were still fighting that thing out. He had lost two decisions and was making an appeal at the time that he died, which always reminds me that if you're going to fly your own plane, hire your own angel. But that's a particular thing. And then likewise, the fifth area is the area of conditions of certification. Conditions of certification. By certification, we mean conditions that are required in order to have the people who work with you duly approved. It's a particular bone right now with Christian schools. And the particular issue that's pending right now is the attempt of some legislators in Virginia to rescind the accreditation of Liberty Baptist College in their teacher training program. Liberty Baptist for some years has certified students when they finished for teaching in Virginia. They received state certification. I've always said any place can do that if they want to, and Liberty Baptist has done that for some time. But in the last few years, a few opposed to them have observed that their students are really not taught evolution and evolutionary principles in any thorough way. And consequently, there's been quite a challenge on the courts right now. When I say right now, I've read about it 2 weeks ago. It's hard to keep up to everything exactly. But been quite a challenge in the courts right now as to whether students could be certified who had not been thoroughly indoctrinated and who then could teach themselves as if it were fact evolutionary principles and practices. Whether they believed it wouldn't be so important, but could they teach it as fact? The concept would be if they went into a school system and they looked at the students and they said, well, here's your great ancestor, and then they snickered, and they would say that their certification could not be bona fide, see, if they couldn't present it as fact. Now, you will see more things along that particular line, I suppose. I picked up not long ago from the Christian Legal Society. Christian Legal Society, headquartered in Oak Park, Illinois, I think is one of the most reputable of sources for materials in this line. Although there are plenty of agencies. I wish I should have prepared a bibliography of agencies. I'm half afraid to do it because about a third of them are nuts, in my judgment. But the Christian Legal Society, headquartered in Oak Park, Illinois, is a good source of what I would say rational and sane approach to a lot of these things. And that doesn't mean that I don't know all they do, but what I've seen, I like. Now, the present secretary of it is Lynn, I would say Buzzard, but he might say Buzzard. Buzzard sounds a lot better, especially if you're the head of a society. And in his particular book, this book published last year, Freedom and Faith, in which a number of essays look at this particular problem, in this text, the secretary of the National Council of Churches, I will indicate to you that Buzzard's book is not written by all evangelicals, but the secretary of the National Council of Churches related 17 areas like these five. My five are included in his 17, and he adds 12 more to them. If you're interested, the account is given in the book, Freedom and Faith by Lynn Buzzard, and he enlists 17. When I looked over the 17, some of them really struck me, see, is what I said earlier, the pendulum. The first thing he objected to was efforts by where they saw these are areas of alarm. Efforts by state and local governments to regulate fundraising by religious bodies. Well, I don't know whether that's an infringement on liberty or not, as we'll define in a few moments. But there are 17 items given. And the reason for that is simple. I might decide to go into fundraising with a .32 pistol. I know it's absurd, but it's not much different than the big limitations. Not much different. It's a little less likely to shoot you on the spot, but it's not much different. And likewise, you get into circumstances like one of our friends in Ohio was in, the running of a number of factories as a means of supporting the church. I wouldn't be hostile to that, except the factories, they attempted to work them as non-profit and as church-related institutions, kind of like the boys that grow and make the wine and the juice and that sort of thing. So when he says that they object to the government regulating fundraising, the government regulates fundraising to some degree for all sorts of things. They just sent a couple of guys to jail in Texas for raising funds by using the mails for fraud. You've seen the ads. Address envelopes at home and make $300 a week. Have you seen those? That's a fraudulent kind of system. Don't ask me. I just read the papers. But I am not about to address envelopes. But the government looks into that sort of thing, and consequently, they limit the fundraising capacity. And if you say to yourself, well, our churches would never do that, there's hardly a sin known among mankind that the church has not at one time or another indulged itself in. Now, by church, I mean the body politic. Not talking about John Willie White Christian, but the body politic. There's hardly a sin of its sort that it hasn't indulged itself in at some time and done it with some justification. So whether all 17 of the areas that the men concluded in their conference in Washington 2 years ago, whether all 17 are bona fide or not, I don't really know. These five, I think, are bona fide, and I think we see a lot of interference in them. And there are others that will come to your mind, too, if you've been reading them, or if you're working with a local church. I then draw your attention to two or three things with regard to some things of prior consideration. Mr. Clark emphasized yesterday in chapel, in our first session, and the nature of our character is a sojourning character. He did not do that to get away with our responsibility. He just emphasized it, and he emphasized it pretty importantly, and I will not say anything more about that now. But you want to remember that, and you want to remember that along with that, our greatest privileges are in serving and knowing God and in executing the will of God. And then a whole bunch of other privileges are accorded to us by virtue of the society which we make up and in which we live. In the light of those things, there are some aspects of privilege that I wonder about. I really wonder about tax exemption for churches. I wonder about it. I'm obviously not going to start yelling for it, but I wonder about it. Probably the best positive treatment on it, probably the best positive treatment was done by this man, Kelly. Dean Kelly. Dean is his first name. Dean Kelly, about 2 years ago. Should churches pay taxes? Kelly is really not an evangelical, so it's always nice to see who's worried about these things. I'll tell you who's worried about them. Well, I might worry too, but Rome worries about it a lot, and the National Council boys worry about it a lot because they've got, to a large extent, tons of property. And some of us other fellows worry about it somewhat too. But that's a question, see. It's a privilege of the church not to pay taxes. Now, if that privilege is granted on the basis that no non-profit body should pay taxes, then you could hardly say the church should pay them. But if that privilege is granted on the basis that religion should not be taxed, then you have to wonder if that privilege is, it's a privilege. But you have to wonder if it's really biblically promoted. I'm not suggesting we pay him. I'm just saying that's one of the things you have to wonder about. And I will tell you this, that in many of our communities, our churches use the services of the communities to some degree. Like if you have a fire, or if somebody breaks in and steals your sound equipment, you call the police. You don't think of calling the denominational headquarters in Elkhart, Indiana, asking for a team of wreckers to come out. So all of those things have to be weighed through. But what I'm saying here is that if the church is seen as another body, the church, the body politic, if it's seen as another non-profit, goodwill to society institution, then it should no more pay taxes than should any other institution. They should all be seen together. But if the church has that deferment, not because it's non-profit, et cetera, but because it is religious in character, then you'll have to wonder if that deferment is bona fide. And I feel the same way about the clergy. Why should they get a special rate to see the baseball games? You can. You can. Or why should they get a special rate for traveling on the train? I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying that's one of the things you have to wonder about. And if you say, well, what does the government have to do with that? The government right now has nothing to do with that. But it's one of those areas where they might suddenly look over the whole train fare situation and say, look, there's got to be a uniform train fare all across the country. Everybody who's going 10 miles pays the same price. I'm making it up, but that's the kind of thing that comes up in governmental circles. They get all these bureaucrats in Washington, and they put together tons of literature. However, I'll just ramble for a minute and tell you that that's one of the things that's described. Biblical is my school, and I'm very enthused for it, but we've already put out about 500 pages of bureaucratic literature, and we're just a little school. If our administration ran the whole country, I hate to think the masses of stuff that could put out. We even have a page-long document that tells us how to vote in the faculty meetings. I'm not making it up. You don't think I'd lie about a thing like that, do you? It doesn't exactly tell you what your vote has to be, but it tells you that you either have to vote yes, no, or abstain. But it takes a page to tell it. And so if we had to charge the whole country, I hate to think what circumstances would be on us. But you wonder about those things. And there may be some other things, too. So it might be that if I go to the ballpark to watch the Phillies. I'd like to get a chance to go to the ballpark, but it might be if I go to the ballpark and watch the Phillies, and I step up and I show them my official papers, where, it's 50 cents off. That's no small deal. It might be I walk up and I show him my official papers, and he looks at me and he says, well, the city of Philadelphia has told us that everybody's got to pay the same to use this stadium, so there's no longer a clergy discount. I don't take them myself, but I'm not just making the story up. Then I might welcome back and say, persecution! They've taken away my special privilege in the community. I hate to tell you, I used to feel that way in the Army, too. I used to feel that the guys who were going in the ministry, the best thing that could happen to them would be about 3 years of frontline action. It weeds out the weaklings and some of the strong. But not 3 years of frontline action, just a little bit of that. And I used to kind of think that myself. And I remember when my own number came up years ago. I'm not a hero, I'm just there. But the circumstance came up, and I knew that in the Second World War, when I was called for military examination, they found so many things wrong with me physically, I thought I'd die before I got home. And when the Korean War broke out, and I was called for a physical immediately, the day after it broke out, I called for all of us fellows. We were nearing the age limit, and I wasn't any better. I'd had a giant breakdown. I'd been sick for a year and a half. I couldn't imagine I was any better. When I took an examination, they slapped me and said, "You're a perfect specimen," and said, "You'll be called in 30 days. Well, instead of being called in 30 days, I volunteered quickly for various reasons. But anyhow, that's neither here nor there today. But I remember the clerk of our presbytery finding out that I was going into the military. And he said, "We could get you a clergy deferment." And he didn't really know that I was leaving them. It was just, I couldn't leave them that day. I was leaving them as soon as I could. And I couldn't really know that. But I've always kind of remembered it with a bitter taste. But actually, the Army is one of the best things that ever happened to me, besides being saved. That's probably first best. Probably being married is next best. And the Army is probably at least the third best. Teaching here in a seminary is about the 12th best, but a lot. Learning how to hunt and fish was fourth. You know, there are a lot of things up and down the line. But those things you'll have to wonder about. So sometimes when somebody says, "The government is requiring us to file a report of our income, that's an invasion of our privacy." Well, it may be an invasion of your privacy, but whether it has anything to do with religion or not may be quite another issue. So I merely mention you have to bear those things in mind. Well, what is religious liberty? Item 3, Roman numeral 3, page 1. What is religious liberty? I define it in 3 steps. Primarily, this is the John 8 passage. Primarily, it's the release from bondage and liberty to know and serve God. That's the first great aspect of religious liberty. The bondage of sin, the bondage of self, freedom from bondage, and the liberty to know and serve God. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, "He that is the Lord's servant is the Lord's free man." Now that's said in a little different context, but you can borrow that. And as I said the other day when I was talking about Solzhenitsyn and his one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, Solzhenitsyn notes that although Alexander, the Russian Baptist fellow, is in prison, he notes that he is a free man. He's free in his soul. And that even though they've got him in bars and working slave labor 14 or 15 hours a day, in his soul he is free. And that's the first level of religious liberty. The freedom to know, freedom from bondage, the freedom to know and to serve God. The second level, as I understand it, you're getting my opinions, you know. The second level, as I understand it, is the ability to propagate and share and inculcate religious ideals. The ability to propagate your faith, to share them with others, and when we say to inculcate them, we mean to teach them to your children and have them move on from generation to generation. That's where we get involved with the Christian schools and all of those movements. But we think that's the second level of religious liberty, the ability to propagate, to share, and to inculcate religious ideals. It grows out of the first. Without the first, the second wouldn't be possible. Consequently, you may be picked up in a communist camp in a country like that. You may be like, I had a friend who for 3 years in communist China was in solitary confinement. I had no reason to doubt his word. He was one of those fellows that no reason to doubt it. For 3 years, he said, he saw no one but the man who threw in his food every day and who once in a while cleaned the cell in which he was housed. He said, for 3 years, he said, I saw no one. How many of you read The Small Woman? Anyone read that lately? Do I have the title wrong? The Small Woman? Gladys Aylward? Yeah, worth reading. Well, the emphasis is that these people, Jeffrey Bull, When Iron Gates Yield, the emphasis is that these people, even when in bondage and absolutely unable to do anything, still had the liberty of knowing God and in their own prayers and hearts served Him. But they couldn't propagate. They couldn't inculcate. They couldn't reach out. You know, when a jailer comes in and throws in your gruel, you might look up at him and say, "Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ." You might say it quickly or slowly, whatever the case might be. But the second level of religious freedom is the one which is very prominent in our culture, the ability to propagate, to share, and inculcate religious ideals. And the third level, tertiarily, how do you like that? The third level, I always hate fellows that in their sermons they go first, second, thirdly, fourthly. You know, if you're going to go first and second, it ought to be third and fourth. If you're going to go thirdly and fourthly, it ought to be firstly and secondly. I just kind of hate with a passion when they switch their adverbial forms around. But that doesn't mean I can't do it, because we always condemn in others what we don't like in ourselves. So in the third place, the third level of religious liberty is the liberty to exercise one's understanding of revelatory mandates in a proper societal setting. I'm not trying to use fancy language, but, you know, your child comes home from school and the teacher has assigned him to watch Dallas on television that night because there's going to be an episode exposing the follies of capitalism. I've never watched Dallas in my life. I've listened to the reviews a time or two, so I am speaking out of ignorance. But it's always appealed to me as the sort of thing I don't want to see and don't want shown in my home. I can remember enough profane words from my boyhood days without going back and picking up any more. But I'm not making a law here for your conscience. But my son comes home. It's hypothetical. He says, my teacher says I've got to watch this program. I look at him and I say, that is a program which we do not approve. And if you're going to watch it, it's going to be through a television set. Out of your room, I'm sorry, you're going to be with a telescope out of your room looking at the neighbors or something like that. And so he says, well, the teacher says if I don't watch it, then I'm on the course. I didn't really have that trouble with any of my children. They weren't going to do any studying anyway, including watching something. My son Douglas was told to watch a particular movie on television, which I thought was an abominable assignment. And I said to him, I said, do you want me to go and talk to the teacher about it? He never did that either. And he said, oh, he said, I'm not going to watch it anyway, Dad. I said, well, what are you going to do? Oh, Dad, he said, I'll hear enough guys talking about it on the way to school to be able to write a report. I don't know if you think that's right or wrong, but I got a complaint about that. He got the best report. Well, you see, that's the liberty to exercise one's understanding. I understand that there's a control in the home of parents over children. And I kind of think that when you get into a state like Sweden where the child can sue you if you spank him, I kind of think that somehow the religious concept, see, it could be a societal concept too, but I somehow think that the religious concept of the parents being the guides to the children is being badly infringed on. As far as I know, that's only been come to court once in the last 2 years in Sweden. But just in the last year, a fellow sued his parents. I don't know how he came out. He first called the police and had them arrested. And secondly, filed suit against them because his father had gotten irritated with his ways and had whammed him a couple of times. And obviously, the father hadn't killed him or he couldn't have called the police, but he'd whammed him a couple of times. I don't believe in child abuse either, but when suddenly you know you get a decree that you cannot chastise the child because the rights of the child for any particular, then you're getting into a situation where my liberty as a Christian parent is being badly infringed upon, I think. That's the third level of Christian liberty. The first one is basic. The second one is the one we share in common. The third is the liberty to exercise one's understanding. Now, your understanding might be that you should never spank them at all. Give them more candy. Give them enough candy, they'll develop some vital illness, and while they're in bed, you can reason with them about the sins of their way and that sort of thing. So it's a matter of how you perceive the revelatory mandate in its proper societal setting. Those things in the background of this are the matters that we call Christian liberty. I've never thought for a moment that Christian liberty was the freedom to go outside the Roman church on Sunday morning and have a German brass band playing so the people inside couldn't hear the mass. I've never thought that that was religious liberty. I've never thought that religious liberty was the ability to suddenly say to somebody, you can't give out tracts anymore. I've thought of all those things. There has to be a responsibility factor there. And most of us in evangelical circles, believe it or not, owe a great deal to the Watchtower people for having fought 7 or 8 very expensive court battles in the religious liberty area. You know, in most of these communities around here, if you want to sell things door to door, you must be registered with the local police department. I'm in favor of that if you're going to sell stuff. But if you want to give out religious literature, you can just go and do it. If you're just going to give it away, you can just go and do it. You cannot stuff it in mailboxes. They're property of the United States government, and if it's not stamped, you ought not to put it there. And you can't clutter, but you can just do it. And if somebody says, are you registered with the police? You can say, no, sir. In the exercise of my religious law, the case of Walcott versus the state of Illinois has established forever that we could There's this sort of thing. We had a similar thing in Philadelphia over street meetings. And Philadelphia is not a bad place to work in, I think, but a similar thing over street meeting. A group was denied a permit to have a street meeting kind of a thing. And I don't know how all the things went, but I was with another group. We went and applied for a permit, too, because I don't think that's an infringement of my liberty to comply with what they want us to do. I think it's an infringement when they say you can't do these things. But I think they wanted to make sure we didn't perform under hospital windows and stuff like that. So we were given a permit to hold street meetings in Philadelphia, a permit that was given for as long as our group or any of its successors continued. That's like, that's like till we all go liberal or die. And so I looked at it and said, this was some years ago, I looked at it and I said, boy, so that's a pretty blank permit. Yeah, the fellow said, and he said, we don't want people not to do these things. He said, we want to know the people who are doing them. That's all. That's all. Well, some people would have thought it was an infringement to have to get a permit. I thought it was kind of nice myself. It looked nice framed beside the flag when we had our services, a permit to hold them forever. But whatever the case might be, I leave those things in religious liberty and go to capital B, the present institution. Now, the United States, the country where most all of us live, at least where we are this morning. You may be a citizen of another land, I don't know. But the present institution. I can't go very far into the background of these things. But you'll remember that Christianity became legal in 313 A.D. in the days of Constantine. It had been illegal for all the years before that. It had not always been hotly persecuted, but sometimes it had been, and a lot of times it hadn't been. But it had grown like crazy. They tell us that probably half the people in the Roman Empire in 313, they tell us probably half the people at that time were professed Christians. And in the eastern part of the empire, probably a good many more were than in the west. They tell us that. I don't know who tells. The they tell us is like Gibbons in his history, but how he got the figures, I don't know. But there certainly were plenty of them because we have records of hundreds and hundreds of churches and church meetings, and some of them when the soldiers came and persecuted them too, and that sort of thing. But it was not widely persecuted at a great deal of time. There were two or three really vigorous ones, and there had been a huge one around 296-305. But Christianity became legal in Constantine's day in 313, within 50 years of that time. Well, that's not exactly right. Well, 365. By 365, it was illegal to be a pagan. By 365, it was a capital offense to go and give a sacrifice to the gods or to be converted to Judaism. So you see, when Christianity became legal, it quickly was moved into a position of enormous authority. And having suffered a long time itself, it kind of joined with the state in making a lot of other people suffer too. So quickly, see, almost everybody became Christians. You have to put quotes on it, italicize it, underline it, hang ice cubes on it, everything else. But quickly, there were Christians everywhere. And as the official religion of the state, after the starting of the synods with the Synod of Arles and Ancyra in 314, the state would carry out the wishes of the church. And so if there was a church court and they decided that you were not adequate for your pastorate, and the people all said we'd like to keep him, but the church court said we'd like to have him, then the soldiers would come and carry you off if necessary. If you walked off on your own power, it was easier. But if necessary, the state would carry out the edicts of the court. And that condition continued pretty well in the Eastern Church up until the coming of the Islamic overthrow of Constantinople in 1453. It continued pretty well for the next 1,000 years in the Eastern Church. In the Western Church, it fell into difficulty because of the collapse of Rome in the 5th century. When Rome collapsed in the 5th century, you began to have the creation of church states, territories in which the church, having been deserted by the army, raised its own army, and build its own fortresses and defended its own people, the church states. Now, Rome is the best example of that, probably, because it was the biggest. But when protection fell down in Rome, two or three attempts were made to revive it over 100 years. When protection fell down in Rome and enemies came in all sorts of ways, and you never knew what would happen, Gregory the Great, finally, about 594, he just raised a whopping big army. Trained it himself, conquered the territories round about, went off and bashed the Normans a couple times, and established a church state in which the church was the authoritarian voice. Now, there were lots of those before the time of Charlemagne, lots of those. But with the coming of Charlemagne, really, I suppose that's 800 AD in or about, but really probably 50 years before that, about 750, and in the years that after that, you get what we call the establishments, in which the church obviously cannot run the state, but the church becomes the franchise property of the state, and the state establishes the church as the religious body of the realm. And growing out of that, you get the two arms theory, which will be seen so often in the Reformation days, in which the state and church govern the people together. I have two or three of these aged portraits in which the state is one arm, the church is the other arm. The state takes care of the technical and the civil services, and the church takes care of where you die and where you're buried and baptized and a lot of things like that. But the establishment was the idea that the state would establish a church, set it up, and it would have a monopoly of a territory. Now, the state churches have been dying in your lifetime. The state's church in Sweden was finally set aside, kind of indirectly, in the last 20 years. The Anglican Church lost many of its privileges in England in the last 50 years. But that was the concept in the establishment, that the state would put a church together. The Enlightenment, whether you like it or not, the books on this subject on the Enlightenment, probably as nice a treatment of it is found in Whitehead's The Second American Revolution. Probably in Whitehead, John N. Whitehead. Whitehead is a good writer. I don't always agree with him either, and he would hate me on some things. On some ideas. But I enjoy what he writes, and he's very thought-provoking. Whitehead, The Second American Revolution, probably has the nicest, most comprehensive chapters on the effects of the Enlightenment that I have read lately. Whitehead's other book, The Stealing of America, is worth reading, too. But the Enlightenment shattered the idea of a church state by arguing that the things that were emotive in people could not be legislated. And then that would soon be applied to Christianity and other religions. And what it meant was that the things that were emotive within you couldn't be acted out by law. That's what it meant. So you couldn't legislate that somebody had to be good. You could put him in jail if he wasn't. But you couldn't legislate that he had to be it bar nothing. And consequently, the governments that developed under the Enlightenment developed separatist ideas on church and state. And whether they are following Rutherford and the Lex Rex or Blackstone, it doesn't make much difference now. The first concrete example of it in the modern world was Thomas Jefferson's writing of the Constitution of the State of Virginia. It precedes the American Constitution by some years, calls for a separation of powers, and then that separation of powers will be repeated in the American Constitution, in which you have a separateness of the authorities. There is no establishment. Religion is the exercise of men, along with other freedoms. And that's a situation which, to a large extent, continued in this country for the last 200 years. Now, if you think today, for example, that your freedom is sometimes infringed on, and it well may be, you have to stop sometime and take sight of all the other freedoms you have. How long we'll have them, I don't know, but we do have them. We still start our Christian schools and do a lot of other striking things. The case in Nebraska is an interesting case that I may comment on in a little bit, but we still start them. If you want to teach your children at home, you can still do that. There are a lot of ways you can do that, and the only problem that I had with that was the kids were smarter than I was. And I like my dog, there was nothing I could learn them, you know. How's that for good English? But you can still do that. There are a lot of things you can do. There are a lot of options that are open to you. We still have enormous freedom. If you want to go out and wrap yourself in a toga and take a pair of sandals and carry a paper cross in your head and walk through Philadelphia and give out tracts, you can do it all day long, unless you might get mugged somewhere, but you can do it all day long. The law will not impede you on those things. There are some things, as I'll mention later, where we have the normal impositions that others have. If you're going to build a church, you ought not to build it on a fire plug. There are a lot of things like that that have to be weighed in view. But we have enormous freedoms, and those things have continued for about 200 years under the general terms of constitutional guarantees. But those constitutional guarantees are being eroded enormously. Although it has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with religion. The erosion of those constitutional guarantees can best be seen in the firearms laws. You can see them there faster than you can see it anywhere else. One of the constitutional guarantees was the right of the citizens to keep and to bear firearms. I'm not sure how you feel about that. I'd like to have a pistol with me right now, but I don't. But that's one of the constitutional guarantees. However, that has been eroded so much that these towns in Illinois could pass the law requiring that there be no firearms kept on the personal property other than some antique thing like a musket or a relic or various other things. New York State has succeeded in passing the handgun law. I'm not in favor of everybody carrying a gun, really. I'm just saying that the freedoms can be seen eroded in that area. And while it has nothing to do with religion, what happens in one area under those common constitutional guarantees will very easily happen in other areas. To keep and bear firearms suggests that they couldn't have 30-millimeter cannons in their houses, because who can bear it? The law, obviously, in the Constitution was designed and intended for the reasonable maintenance of your own safety and property and not for having a Sherman tank to go and attack the local grocery store. So the law carried with it certain suggestive provisions along those lines. But you can easily see those things being eroded. And constitutional guarantee right now, I'll say this as negatively as I can, right now, in the way the courts have been interpreting things in the last few years, constitutional guarantee means almost nothing. It means a great deal of confusing language. However, we still live in a country where those things can be changed. You work to vote for better people or other people or something like that, and justices die and other justices replace them, and lots of things can happen. But that's the way I see those things. In addition to that, of course, in the present institution, you have the additional matter of states' rights. Now, that's where the Nebraska situation is interesting. The laws that are being used in Nebraska to keep this fellow in prison, 3 weeks ago he was back in jail. My heart aches for him. I don't have any real criticism to find, except in the whole, he shouldn't have lived in Nebraska. But Nebraska has a set, I'm not saying they're wrong either, but they have a set of laws which we in Pennsylvania do not have. That's not because we're better than they are, it's just that we don't have them. And one of the reasons we don't have them were the great number of Amish in Pennsylvania and Mennonites. The Amish and Mennonites argued that they could set the standards for their own education within reasonable bounds, and the State Educational Bureau accepted that. Let them read and write, let them go 8 grades, let them be taught by people that are satisfactory to you. 2/3 of the teachers in Amish schools have never gone to high school. They were brainy kids who finished their 8 grades, worked on the farm, went back and taught. Now, I can't say 2/3 today. That was true 2 years ago. They went back and taught. So the kid coming out of the Amish school can read and write better than anybody almost coming out of the Philadelphia school system, except a few phenoms that are really super. They can read and write. They can do their figuring. They know how to work, and they're ready to go to work on the farm. In the cases where they decide to go on to local high schools, they almost always come on in good standards and do that in college, too. So in Pennsylvania, what has been required of parochial institutions is that the institution be satisfied with your credentials. But that's not true in Nebraska, see. Nebraska, with a state certification, has got these people over a ferocious barrel. My heart aches for them. With their desire to have the A school in their church. The A school is a perfectly good program, a wonderful program, if you have good administrators and supervisors. It's a terror if you have poor ones. But just believe me on that for the moment. But they've got them over a barrel over there. This man was back in jail 3 weeks ago. He might be out today. He was back in jail 3 weeks ago, and the judge had said he would stay there until all the people who had their children in his school last year had promised they would go to the town school this year. Now, that thing has been in courts under several different acts. There's been reversals, and I don't know what but 3 weeks ago he was back in jail until the folks had promised. And his statement in the little newsletter that I picked up said that he was not going to ask them to promise. He said if any of them promised, he would be disappointed in them. And he said, I certainly am not going to ask them to promise. He said, I have a rather comfortable place here in this jail. That probably was said with a note of sarcasm. Of course, there are a lot of things that aggravate a thing like that. Sometimes in the framework of states' rights, one tiny agreement. You see, sometimes people take their religious liberties and push hard. I remember the circumstance in which one of our friends was fighting to save his radio license near Philadelphia. And the biggest single factor in the loss of his license was the unwillingness to send his log to the FCC in advance. Now, whether you think that's right or wrong is kind of beside the point. I look at it and say, my word, you've got to have it. Send it off to him. Who cares? You know, who cares? If you want to change it, you can change it on 5 minutes. But just send it off to them. But those folks contended that the log was the private property of their religious idealism. And I kind of thought, see there, that they brought religious faith. I kind of thought they made a problem for themselves. like I would make for myself if the policeman stopped me on the road and said, "May I see your driver's license?" And if I said to him, "I'm a religious person, everything about me is religious, my driver's license is part of my religious conviction, I don't show it to unbelievers." If then he turned out to be a member of First Baptist in Percocet, I guess I'd have to show it to him. But that kind of a circumstance. So states' rights really complicated because every state, they have different problems. Right now in Pennsylvania, we're going through a thing that I am not happy with. But we're taking in Harrisburg, there's a bill to take the control of the educational system away from the Pennsylvania Educational Department and put it under the legislature. Again, that's Pennsylvania. I'm very unhappy with that. I've written my state representatives a couple times. I'm unhappy with it, but it's not because the education department's done so good. The education department in the state, I think, has often been a fiasco. But whenever they did something that we didn't like, we could go to them and say, "We're going to the legislature." And then they would shake in their shoes and rethink the whole thing. Now, the legislature is the most insensitive body in the whole Commonwealth. The only person who cares less for you than the legislature is John Paul II. But they're the most insensitive body in the whole Commonwealth. And I just hate to think what will happen if all those things come under the legislature's control. Maybe it will. Say it's not a religious matter, but that's part of your involvement in life. And so I mentioned that a government of law, subject to wily dictates and loopholes and misunderstandings, the law is enormously... Suddenly you can be legal and illegal all at the same time. And not really know it. Like me paying my income taxes. I try to pay them honestly, but I suddenly realized I had fallen behind a particular thing. I wrote them a long apologetic note and said, and nobody ever said beans. They just cashed the check and that was it. But I had thought it was legal, but it wasn't. And there are all sorts of devices and gizmos. I'm either legal today or they're waiting to catch me. But try to be it. Now, with regard to this matter of religious liberty and state infringement, I mentioned these four basic positions which are held within the framework of the church. Some of them are not held very much. The Roman position, believe it or not, is that the government of Church of Rome is above the government of states and countries and superior to it. That has been the Roman position. It is the Roman position. There has been no release of that officially. They are above and superior to the governments of local countries. The edicts of Gregory the Great, I'm sorry, Gregory the Seventh, the edicts of Gregory the Seventh, the edicts of Leo XIII, the edicts of Pius XII, all stand in that line. And so they have seen the state governments as being inferior to their positions. It's interesting what's happening in Poland. It's also kind of frightening. I don't like to see anybody have troubles, but it's hard to know how things are going to go in Poland in the next few years. The principal primate in Poland today seems to have a conciliatory spirit which may smack of compromise, and it may not augur good for what they want to do in Poland. I don't know. But that's the Roman position. The Erastian position was promoted at the time of the Reformation by Thomas Erastus. The Erastian position is just the opposite of the Roman position. It's the view that the state is everything. And that since it's ordained of God, all you are is a pawn in its hands. I don't know how far Erastus carried that. He kept leaving places like Geneva and whatnot because they were too hot for him. That the state was everything and you were a pawn in his hands. That's very much the view of the communist societies, although they would hardly call it that. But that's very much their view. The reform camps have generally followed two areas. Reformed is not purely reformed here. It would include the Lutheran communions and a number of communions of similar background. But they generally followed two views. The smaller view was an absolute non-participation in political or civil affairs. An absolute non-participation in political and civil affairs. That's the smaller group, but there have always been a few of them around. They're best represented in the United States by the Reformed Presbyterian Church, the Geneva people. I've had some of those for friends all of my life, time, almost. My friend was My friend's father was a distinguished professor of English at a school in Pittsburgh for many years, but he would not sign a loyalty code to the United States. He said, I'm loyal to God, and being loyal to God, he said, I'm loyal to a good citizen at the time of the McCarthy problems and all. He said, I certainly am signing no loyalty codes. He said, I'm just passing through here anyway. And consequently, his position was forfeited. He lost his position. He lost it happily. Someone said he should have sued. No, he didn't sue. He didn't take people to court either. See, so he just went happily and went over to become, worked at Geneva College for a while. And they called him for jury duty, called my friend for jury duty. And that's a kind of an interesting sort of thing, called him for jury duty and asked all the jurors. He used to go through a rigmarole on jury duty as to whether or not you'd be honest, fair, and all that sort of thing. He would neither say yay nor nay. He would say, he just looked. And when it was pressed on him, what would he be? He said, well, I'm a Christian, he said. Everybody knows what Christians stand for. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So they dismissed him. He didn't have to sit there for 2 weeks on jury duty, one thing or another. The other reform group has believed in a participation in the affairs of government, but not in the control of same. But they believed in a participation in it. Some of the reform bodies championed a state church. The Lutheran Church championed a state church. Presbyterians did where they could. But I mentioned there are those two groups. They favored a participation, but not a control. The Anabaptists, I'll tell you something that's really nasty. The Anabaptists, of whom a lot of us are descended in some way, or a lot of you are descended in some way, or a lot of people are descended in some way, and generally took a position of non-interference in state affairs and non-resistance to state policies, generally took that position. The only time in the world that they ever had an opportunity to be the chief power in a state, they turned it into a bloody tyranny. And when my friends say to me, we never persecuted anybody, I've said, yeah, anytime you had a chance, you did. I had three Baptist roommates when I went to college. Boy, did they persecute me. Night and day, they persecuted me. But in those days, I was equal to it. Long time ago. And when the Anabaptist leaders took over the city of Munster in Germany in 1535, they turned it into a bloody tyranny. First thing they did was reintroduce polygamy. Well, there were more women than there were men, I guess. Maybe it wasn't the first thing they did. The second day they did that. And various other things. All I'm saying is that anybody who gets in control has a tendency to abuse power. But generally speaking, the Anabaptist teachings have said that they would not be involved in the governmental processes and would be non-resistors to its influence. Generally speaking. Not far from here, we have a good friend who is, the only way you can describe him with quotes is a warlike Mennonite. That's the only way you can describe him. And I don't know how to say it exactly right, so you'll have to, and what I mean by that is that he's a strong Mennonite farmer, and but argued strongly that America ought to go to Vietnam and clean them all up. And last time I saw him, he said we ought to leave an army in Grenada. He said, put 500,000 men down there. He said, so see, he's, but in his own church, they constantly wonder whether to move him or lose him. I don't know what to do. He's an exceptional type of fellow, but a warfaring Mennonite, exceptional type of fellow. Those are the essential postures that you'll find in the situation. Now, of course, those postures have sometimes been somewhat altered by the present institution. So even though that there might be people who believe in vigorous participation, they found the political machinations in the United States so corrupt that they don't want to get into it. I'm not that negative, really, but that is just about true. I don't know, is Paul Clymer related to you, Wayne? Is he related to you? Distantly, okay. Wouldn't want to talk about Wayne's relations close hand. Mr. Clymer represents the state of Pennsylvania in the legislature, not from my district, but from this district and Sellersville and Percussie. I'm over with Mr. Wilson. I met Mr. Clymer at the shopping center one day. Clymer has a nice testimony and I think really tries to serve the Lord in his political office. I've been pleased with his views and attitudes and that kind of stuff. But I met him over in a shopping center one day and he was passing out things, getting ready to run for election, re-election. I think he's up this fall again if he's continuing. He's getting ready to run for re-election. And so I asked him if he was enjoying himself, and he said, yeah, he was enjoying himself. He hoped I'd vote for him, and I said, I live in the other district, Paul. See, it's Paul. You know, all the politicians want to get on buddy terms, and so I said, I live in another district, Paul. I said, I couldn't vote for you if I wanted to. But I knew his pastor and knew his church, and indirectly knew him, so I asked him how things went, and well, and I said, how do you find a political climate? I can't quote him word for word. He said, I find there are lots of difficulties and lots of things in it that I don't like. But he said, I want to serve God there. Well, I admire a fellow who takes that stance, see. But you'll discover that there are an awful lot of things in it. William Jennings Bryan, years ago, was enormously prominent in politics. He's better remembered for the Scopes trial when he withstood Clarence Darrow, who emphasized various things on monkeys and whatnot. But what is often forgotten is that in politics, Bryan and Darrow belong to the same party. And twice in Chicago, Darrow was the chairman of the Bryan for President Committee, and really a close political friend, see. So politics really runs you in rather ragged circles. And of course, unpopular people couldn't be elected anyhow, so I've never tried to run for office myself. That's kind of the participation thing of it. Now I wanted to mention two or three things, a few questions to be addressed. I've got to address them rapidly. To what extent are our liberties biblical? Well, that's a big thing. I sketched the type of religious liberty earlier, and look and I saw it, but you know, if I may have a liberty which may or may not be biblical, like the liberty to have a senior citizen's card, which entitles me to 10% off at the Revco drugstore. I haven't gotten my card yet, but I'm about to apply. The total amount of drugs I've bought in the last 5 years have been one bottle of aspirin, but you never can tell when 10% off might do you good. Is that a religious liberty? No. It's a liberty, but not religious, don't you think? Not religious. And you'll discover that there may be a lot of other things like that, too. I should say biblical, not biblical. Maybe a lot of other things like that that are liberties to us in the present that are not biblical. I'd still like to keep every liberty that I could, but I have to make a sharp distinction when it comes to this matter of infringement as to whether people are stepping on the grounds that God has given or just on some little chestnut that I cherish. I have to watch that pretty closely. And the second question, can we have a state and not make some deferment to it? And the answer is no. You cannot have a societal order and not make some deferment to it. The Mayflower Compact, that primary document drawn up on the Mayflower out in the windy waters of the ocean in the cold of winter, is a prime example of it, where they had one mind and one concern, but any time a government is formed, there's got to be some degree of deferment to it. The problem with governments like ours is they keep pushing the degree of deferment, and after a while, you know, you've deferred everything. But there's got to be some deferment to it. And sometimes when you get around some of the Christian lobbyists, you get the feeling that they want no deferment to it. And when I see that they object to the fact that the government regulates fundraising projects, I say to myself, that's crazy. The government regulates fundraising products for Procter & Gamble. Fundraising has very little to do, in my mind, with religious liberty. The big fundraising in the Bible is in 1 Corinthians 16. And it's pretty hard to argue against that. Yeah, you bring out of the abundance that God has given you and throw it in the basket, which reminds me that I have an offering box in the hall. Although it's not the first day of the week, but I have an offering box in the hall, if anyone, quite a few have, just in case anyone missed my note on that. So it's impossible to have a state and not make some deferments to it. Can we exist in a detached way? Can the believer exist within the state, in a detached way? Can he just live there and not be either bothered by it or contribute to it? And the answer is it's very difficult. Very difficult. To what extent are the edicts of law binding? Well, Dr. Newman touched on this a bit with regard to his discussion the other day. You really have to get all these discussions because when I come to something I don't know what to say about, I like to say that Newman covered it or Clark covered it or McRae covered it. That way, but I thought he touched on it well the other day. And the concept is that they are binding to the assent, they're binding to the degree that we give common assent to them, and to the degree where they do not supersede some higher concept of authority, like God. So if there's a law passed that says you can't pray, it has transcended, I'm sorry, it's cut across a divine mandate. So you may want to do like Daniel did, you may want to open your window wide and pray three times daily so that everybody can see you and know that you're being civilly disobedient at that point, understanding that that is an obedience to God. And the same time he was doing it, he did not have a submachine gun aimed out the window to spray the castle. And this last question, the fifth one rather, what can we make of our sojourner character? Well, as Mr. Clark said, see, we go back and forth on these things. You have to remember that it's real. I'm hoping to speak at a Christian school tonight for their graduation. The theme I'm working on is to remember their Christian character. I'm sorry, to remember their pilgrim character. I don't know if they'll listen or not, because people are graduating are like people are getting married. They hardly know what's going on. The service is just there. But I'd like to remember that myself, too. I think that's rather important, see, that I not become too detached or too involved. And to what degree are we willing to extend the freedoms we seek? That's a real big one. And you go down to the airplane terminal, and suddenly you're met by 8 Hare Krishna guys, each one balder than the former. And each one, 8 Hare Krishna types, and by the time you get through the Hare Krishna types, you run into 5 or 6 black Muslims. When you've gotten past the black Muslims, then you run into 2 or 3 of Herbert Armstrong boys. They've been showing up until that one lady. And by the time you get through them all, you say, "What are these guys doing in the airport?" You'll see a big sign that says, "Because of your service at the airport." But you say, "What are they doing in the airport?" And if you're not careful, you'll say something like, "They all ought to be thrown out." Or you'll think it. But the moment you think that, you're thinking of yourself. And the only reason that they're so prominent in the airport is that they go there. When you and I go to the airport, we mouse to get our tickets and go to our plane. We don't spend the half hour that we're not waiting. You might see, but I have many weaknesses, but I don't think I could take along 200 tracks while waiting for the plane. I could walk around and get them out in the airport. I have as much freedom to do it as any Hare Krishna. In fact, more. I've got a ticket. Well, I think we should do it. I have done a little, but not enough. I'm a weakling. But I kind of think I know, within reason. I think it's also well to look for somebody that's sitting all alone and try to strike up a conversation. Although in Philadelphia, they're likely to think you're a thug going to grab their purse and run. But they're apparent because they're doing something, and we're not apparent because we're not. But the day that I look and say, "Get rid of them," I'm really saying, "Get rid of me." And it's really a kind of a striking sort of thing. So those are questions that have to be answered in the whole infringement thing. And sometimes, I'll tell you, in the 30s, we went through a bad time with radio. Because in the 30s, there was a massive attempt by the Federal Council of Churches to gain control of radio broadcasting time with the major networks in the 30s. And one of the bases that they worked on was the fact that a lot of the preachers who were on in the 30s were crude and vulgar and didn't have good grammar. And said, "Ain't it great to go to heaven?" and stuff like that. They worked on that streamline. Fortunately, there were Christians that worked against that, and their designs were frustrated before they got a grip on that sort of thing. But it was really a critical time in the 30s. I just read the books about it today. I was alive then, but I wasn't worried about radio at all, unless the pirates were on. So I only know that from having read the books on it today. But the concept was that they said, because there's this abuse and this abuse and this abuse, we ought to regulate things. And every now and then we think that way, but when we have to remember that when we regulate things, we will also be regulating ourselves. So you just have to take it in stride to see that the regulations go well. Finally, my notes on the areas of infringement. State infringement on religious liberty. Well, in the first place, I mentioned these first three items without batting an eyelash. It's surely infringement on biblical posture when there's a prohibition of the exercise of faith in God. That is not a problem in the United States today, but it is a problem in Russia and a problem in lots of other places. That surely is an infringement on the biblical posture. Likewise, when there's inhibiting of the propagation of the faith, peculiarly in family status. If we get to a situation where they try to forbid us to have our schools and our family teachings and whatnot, that becomes an infringement on religious liberty. In my understanding, because that falls into my province as a religious person to propagate and to inculcate my faith. And likewise, an infringement is found when there is a legislating in life areas governed by God that makes conformity difficult for the believer. Well, I was struck, see, in Minneapolis, where this lady went to church on Sunday morning instead of going to the union meeting. The union had a law that if you weren't at the meeting, you would lose your status in the union and lose your job. And so they fired her. They dropped her from the union, and because it was a closed shop, she lost her job because she went to church on Sunday. In that particular case, believe it or not, the American Civil Liberties Union, a bad bunch if there ever was one, but in that particular case, the American Civil Liberties Union undertook her defense, sued in her behalf, and won her case. Because they said that the law that infringed on her religious liberty was contrary to the best interests of the person in the country. So she got to go to church, keep her union membership, and keep her job all by the same time. Well, that was a law made by a union. But it's not hard to have laws made by companies like that. We've had one of our companies around here that didn't operate on Sundays for years. Now, I'm only right now a hearsay person, so I might be wrong. But the party who told me is an employee for the company. And she said to me, she said they decided to stay open on Sundays. And they told us if we didn't work on Sundays, just to quit, they said. We didn't want to work, just to quit. Well, quitting and being fired are two different things. But it becomes rather easy to see them saying, well, if church means that much to you, you really don't need this job. There are a lot of other things you can do. And, of course, those are company and union laws, but it's easy to see the state coming up with laws like that, too. Like making election day on Sunday. You know, there's been quite a push for that. Have the elections on Sunday, then everybody would be free to go. Although today, you'd have to get them back from the beach and the shore, all these crazy places. And the suggestion was they'd ask all the churches for one Sunday to suspend their services. You can see my church suspending its services for people to vote on Sunday. You can see it. No, you can't see it. You can see all the Dutchmen where we fellowship, you can see them standing out and reading to hold their Bibles, shaking their Bibles and saying, oh, we're going to church. Yes, that's what you can see. And that isn't because we go every Sunday. Some of them go away and you don't see them for a month. But we think that our religious liberty is to worship the Lord, and the first day is when we like to hassle at that. Then there are some areas where infringement is a practical or potential possibility. Religious faith becomes a means for the establishment of prejudicial treatment. In other words, they turn the thing around on you and they say, well, if you're a religious person, we will not hire you. And so you appeal to the court, and the court says, that's right, religious people are more loyal to God than to their employers, so nobody has to hire them. We do not have that today, but there have been places where that has been a problem, and it may well be a problem. So what I'm saying is that when your religious faith, when your personal religious faith becomes a means for your disestablishment, then that's an infringement on your liberty. A potential infringement. There are a lot of factors in there you'd have to know more about. And secondly, where the greater accountability becomes a supposed basis for discriminatory action. That's a complicated wording. Looked at it in my typewriter for a long time and said, you're not going to get it right on a typewriter, so try to take a shot at it when you're with the group. And here's what I have in mind. You have the religious school. You have the A school. Your students are doing better on every kind of a test than the students from the local public school are doing, and in every kind of a way. They consistently outdo them. But your products are not seen as any basis for legitimacy for your continued operation. And so, they argue that since your students are not in the public level, the greater accountability of the public level becomes a basis for discriminating against what you're doing. That's exactly what the Nebraska thing is. Denying the students the social benefits of hobnobbing with the other guys at recess and sitting in a class where a lot of people aren't paying attention. And the greater accountability that they should have exercised becomes a grounds for discriminating against the maintenance of the school and the particular action. Unwilling to take into view the results or the products or anything else. The idea is if you have a greater accountability than just getting those kids to be smart, just getting them to have a good degree. I've seen some of those schools that were abominable and should have been closed, incidentally, by somebody. I've seen some public schools that were abominable. I've suffered through both kinds, good and bad. And the fact that a thing calls itself a Christian school does not mean it's good. It doesn't mean that it gives an education, just frankly. It doesn't even mean it gives good religious values. Everything kind of has to be weighed on itself. So I'm not saying here that every particular situation is right or wrong. I'm saying that if the greater accountability becomes a means of prejudicing a cause against you, that becomes a potential cause of infringement on your religious liberty. And in the third place, there are some cases where I don't think it's infringement at all. I don't think myself paying the income tax is an infringement. And I personally don't think paying the Social Security tax is an infringement. I have a lot of friends who do. But I personally don't think it is. I think it's asked of all citizens in due care. We could take, if we wanted to, we could do what the Amish have done. We could figure out ways to get around it. The Amish have done that rather nicely. It's taken them about 6 legislative acts in Congress, 3 or 4 court trials, and a bunch of other things, but it can be done if you want to do it legitimately. But I personally don't think that's a bad thing. In fact, I think that's accountable. I've really been bothered by the Christian school movements that resist that. They already don't want to pay their teachers hardly enough to live on, and then don't want to provide any, et cetera. You can see I feel warmly about those things. So I personally don't think that's an infringement. But if you do, I won't think anything less of you until after lunch. And then I also don't think it's an infringement when we're asked to participate in issues for the common welfare, when such don't go beyond duties of God. When we're asked to tell how many students we have in the school, when we're asked to participate in the blood bank program, you're not compelled to. But I don't think those things are any infringement of religious liberty. The blood bank program certainly isn't. But many times we get so sensitive to the issue that anything anybody asks us to do is an infringement. One of my daughters once in school, we've had 5 children, they're all somewhat grown. One of my daughters, after a big class in civics, all that sort of thing, came home announcing the freedoms of the individuals. Think for it now, right? The freedom of the individual. Like, why should she have to do dishes without being paid for it? But a nice solid reason, hardly brought off the ground. A nice solid reason. What she was seeing was that every act that was brought to her, contrary to her desires, was an impairment of her liberty. But that really isn't so. Sometimes the things that are brought to us are just designed for better decency and order. And we would not be amiss on that. We certainly haven't touched on everything this morning. I mentioned that I think one of the most reliable sources of information is the Christian Legal Society. It does a nice job of that. And down on the table downstairs, you'll see a group which I think is much less reliable, represents a different view, but is worth knowing about. And that's the Coalition of Unregistered Churches. I think they put out a lot of stuff, and some of it is really good. You can see an address down on the table in the hall. Some of it is really good. You ought to pick up their Nebraska story. In comic book form, which most of you would enjoy tremendously. And it's free down there, I think, so you ought to pick one up and put it. They represent somewhat of a different side, and I'm not totally, but I know what they're doing. So they represent a source of information that's worth having. The moral majority reports are worth having, too, from the point of view of a general thing. They're not nearly conservative enough for some of us and not liberal enough for others, but anyhow, they represent a source of information. And other than that, I can't tell you anything further, I think. I've mentioned a few books that we've read. I will say you have to keep your eyes open. Liberties rarely just run away all at once. They erode away slowly. But when they are gone, they are gone. And they usually, having gone one step, the important thing is not to lose the first step, because it's like going down an escalator, starting down is easy, going back is up. When I was, an old man in our church years ago related for me the steps that led from saving faith and preaching in the denomination. And I shan't tell you about it. He said this. He said, remember, he said, the step that's taken downward is taken backward with great difficulty. So he said, don't depart from thing until you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd say you need to watch the liberty concept very closely. I'm not really happy with groups like the Liberty Lobby. I think they represent, but please don't hold it against them. I think they represent an irrational segment in right-wing thinking. But again, they become sources of truth. And if you're a big pusher of theirs, then probably you're irrational too. Whatever else is, we're all friends here. Say, lunch is being served downstairs. The contribution box is on the table. The class this afternoon, Mr. Hardy, is a good class, 2:30. We don't have to close the doors this afternoon. Right temperature here this afternoon. And somebody said that my hot was my coat. No, I'm trying to use the temperature change. I hate air conditioning with a passion. I really thought yesterday was 103 and here was just right. We always tell the truth, too. So go and enjoy lunch.